Okay, Kerr and I initially thought we would give you a big picture talk, sort of relating our work to evolutionary cell biology. And then we decided we weren't competent to decide what evolutionary cell biology is, and that we should probably, instead of giving you the big picture talk, we should give you a couple of small picture talks. Quite small, actually. So this is going to be, we're each going to talk about a story that, one simple story, which will be pretty much straight biology without any overlay of implications for evolutionary cell biology. And these stories we've picked because they're puzzling to us. In one case, because it reveals pretty astonishing capabilities of a cell that you wouldn't suspect. And in the other case, because we thought we would be able to understand it using simple biophysical principles like protein binding and diffusion and so forth, and we've failed to do that. So I guess basically we're asking for help is what we're doing here. So let me introduce first the organism that we're working with. This is Toxoplasma gondii. It's a small, single-celled eukaryotic organism shaped like a fat banana. And this image, you're seeing Toxoplasma cells free in suspension, but in fact, that's not the way it spends most of its life, and in fact, cannot survive in this form for very long. It normally lives inside other cells. It's an obligate intracellular parasite. So in this image, which shows human fibroblasts infected with Toxoplasma, so this would be a human fibroblast here, and here's another one here. And this would be the nucleus of that cell, nucleoli there. And these cells look like any fibroblast from any organism, epithelial cell, except for these things in the cytoplasm, which are Toxoplasma gondii. They are included in a vacuole that they've created when they've invaded the cell, and within that vacuole they'll replicate asexually about every 6 to 8 hours. So Toxoplasma has an alveolate in the phylum Apicomplexa here. This phylum includes about 5,000 species of obligate intracellular parasites. 5,000, of course, is a suspiciously round number, and supposedly there are 4,600 named species, but the actual number, the estimates for the actual number vary from 5,000 to 30,000, so I'd have to say it's unknown. Toxoplasma is a ubiquitous parasite. It will infect any nucleated cell in any tissue in any warm-blooded animal, from birds to humans. So worldwide, about 25% of the human population is permanently infected. Worldwide, 10% to 90%, depending on species, of domestic and wild animals are permanently infected. 1 out of 5 people in this room is permanently infected. So what permanently infected means is that in the tissue, particularly skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, and brain, there will be these cysts. Here's an example of one isolated live from a mouse brain. And those cysts contains thousands or tens of thousands of live Toxoplasma in a very slowly growing form. Normally this infection is asymptomatic. If you are otherwise healthy individual, you probably wouldn't know that you have this, and you will die with this instead of from this. You'll keep it for your entire life. Occasionally these cysts leak, and that maintains the immune response to Toxoplasma, some of the parasites get out into the circulation. Toxoplasma is very antigenic, which is, if you look at these pictures, you wouldn't believe it, because there is no inflammatory reaction around these cysts, and that's characteristic. It's quite clever in evading the immune system.
So what exactly is a cyst?
A cyst is a ball of cells bound by a material whose composition is unknown, but supposedly is like a cell wall. Right? They would normally be intracellular, but can be ejected from the cell. It is formed by the parasite, and so, we made a joint decision here that we were going to defer questions about the life cycle and Toxoplasma and some other really fascinating stuff. Because if we start talking about it, I know this group, we'll never get to the cell biology.
Okay, fair enough.
So we're going to defer those questions later. We'd be delighted to sit down and talk to you, any one of you, Sanglier in groups for hours and hours about toxoplasma and regale you with stories about things that sound more like science fiction than science. But for the moment, let me just keep to what I'm in it. Okay, so it's a cyst. It contains a bunch of parasites. Right.
Okay.
It does have a sexual stage. It has the complete life cycle that includes one full host, which is members of the cat family. Co will mention that a little bit. We're not going to talk about it in detail here. It doesn't actually matter for us. Nevertheless, in spite of the fact that those infections are mostly asymptomatic, it is a pathogen. It causes lethal encephalitis in immunocompromised adults, and it causes severe congenital neurological defects if the primary infection occurs during pregnancy, particularly during early pregnancy. In most countries, congenital toxoplasmosis is a leading cause of congenital neurological defects. Okay, that's it for the bare bones introduction. Now let me turn to the first of the stories we're going to talk about. So how to build a parasite. We want to know how to build a parasite because it turns out that the pathogenesis depends on building parasites. If it doesn't replicate, it doesn't cause the disease. So how to build a parasite. And how to make two copies is the first question, because that's what's going to happen. So here's a cartoon diagram of toxoplasma. If you looked at a diagram of any other apicomplexan, the shapes would vary quite a lot, but in essence, every item in this cell would be present in those other apicomplexans, in some version of it. So it's a polarized cell. We have what we call an apical end and a basal end. Here's a sort of semi-transparent view, and here's a view of a cell, and this cell is in the process of building daughters. So apicomplexans build daughters inside the mother cell. So what we have here is a mother surrounded by a plasma membrane and then some other cytoskeletal elements lining the outside. And inside the mother are two developing daughters, each of which is being assembled inside a cytoskeletal scaffold. So the components here, or you can see, this is a small cell, but it has a full complement of all eukaryotic organelles. ER, Golgi, mitochondrion, it has some extra ones, invasion organelles and so forth. So this cytoskeletal scaffold is built de novo, and then the membrane-bound organelles of the mother are divided by fission, and those are stuffed into this scaffold. So here would be a cell in interphase. Here's the one I just showed you with developing daughters and the nucleus being partitioned between the two daughters. And this process goes on, filling up this scaffold with the pieces that it needs to be an adult toxoplasma. And then when each of the daughters has everything they need, then the two daughters bud out of the mother and take over the plasma membrane of the mother. So at this stage, there is no membrane separating these daughters from the mother. These are free in the cytoplasm. Here it takes over the plasma membrane of the mother and becomes an adult toxoplasma. Typically there are some bits left over of the mother because these things, these cytoskeletal pieces are constructed de novo, not reused from the mother. So there's some bits left over, and those are dumped into a sort of trash pile, which is recycled later into amino acids and so forth.
Is this thought to be perfectly symmetric?
I'm sorry?
Is the division perfectly symmetric?
Do you mean are the shapes according to
that? In the sense that there's no distinction between mother and daughter once the division occurs there.
So the mother has essentially disappeared.
Yeah.
Okay, it's gone. The pieces, there will be some pieces down here in what we call the residual body, but the mother is gone. Right? And this, some of this is de novo construction, some of it is inherited from the mother by fission. So like the Golgi splits in two in one, each one.
And the sequestration of leftover bits between two daughters.
I think we'd have to say we don't know, but we presume it is. We really don't know.
The Rotaries and Microaemes, how do they get, I'm just trying to, from your diagram, how do they get down inside? Because you were saying that by vision,
I haven't drawn them. I haven't drawn them here. And in fact, I don't actually say, Kerr might know. I don't actually know because, in fact, as I'll show you in a moment, copying these guys is one of the last things that happens. So I have to say, I don't know how that happens. Do you know, Kerr?
So actually, I just spotted there was a mistake. The Eurasian organelles are mostly made kind of like the cytoskeleton elements.
Oh, they're made de novo.
De novo. Yeah. Okay.
You need to talk much louder because the recording will pick it up. I'm not sure whether you can hear.
So John made a mistake. the Eurasian organelles, they are made de novo. So Golgi is elongated and divided by fission, but a number of other organelles actually made new in the daughter parasites while the mother copy is still there.
So these are pinching off from the Golgi as this thing's moving. Okay, makes sense.
How long does it take?
So I'll show you in just a second. Okay, all right. So this is toxoplasma, and they divide by making two daughters like that, and that process is called endodiogeny. Other members of the apicomplexans, this is uncommon among the apicomplexans. Most apicomplexans make multiple daughters at once. For instance, Plasmodium makes 8 to 16 at once. In one very brief phase of its life cycle, toxoplasma is capable of making multiple daughters at once, but except for that very brief phase, which occurs only in the definitive host, it's always two, said to be religiously two. Okay, so figuring out the cell cycle in these bugs was a bit of a problem for many years until the advent of the fluorescent proteins, because if you look by phase contrast or DIC, any form of transmitted light microscopy, you really don't see much until the daughters begin to bud out, as they're doing here. But all of the karyokinesis and the organelle duplication and so forth is pretty much invisible. With the advent of the fluorescent proteins, we can tag proteins that are specific for any organelle, and we can now follow the assembly of all of them. And for instance, here, this is a vacuole containing four parasites, and each of the parasites is making two daughters. That's these horseshoe-shaped things. Notice that the daughters can be arranged in lots of different ways, side by side or at right angles or end to end. And in fact, as you'll see in some movies that Kuz is going to show you later, they bounce around inside here quite a lot.
Can you say quickly how much genetics you have in this organism?
We have, so it's haploid, okay? So we can do knockouts. To do crosses is so messy and complicated that it's rarely done because the sexual phase happens only in the intestine of a cat. So, yeah, right. Inconvenient from that respect. But we can do all sorts of, we can make transgenics, homologous replacements, knockouts, all that kind of stuff. Okay, so let's just point out what I tend to forget is that that people don't realize that out here it looks black, but this is not empty. Host cell out here, right? So always in these images we show you, there'll be a host cell out here, which is not visible here because it's not expressing any GFP. Okay, so an answer to your question. So by marking proteins specific for different organelles, we can establish the pattern of cell division, and we can make out a diagram like this, essentially a choreography of cell division. And this happens the same way in every cell, all the time, with pretty much the same timing. So the first event is centriole duplication. The centriole is normally at the apical end of the cell. It moves to the basal end, duplicates, and then moves back up to the apical end. And that, then succeeding that are replication copies of the Golgi and the apicoclasts. DNA synthesis occurs over about a two-hour period, hour and a half period. The last thing is division of the mitochondria, and then finally parasite emergence. There's some maturation that continues to occur after the daughters bud out of the mother. So overall, 6.5 to 7 hours, something like that, process.
These guys actually have one mitochondria.
There's one mitochondria, and it splits as we go. Let's see. All right. So this is a parasite that's been transfected with a tagged copy of the histones. And that, it's not going to play. At any rate, it allows us to see the nucleus in the cell, which is quite convenient for some things that we're going to do later. I'll show you about that. At any rate, it marks the nucleus quite nicely. All right, so shortly after we acquired the ability to see this thing, we got a surprise, in which is that in rare instances, toxoplasma can make more than two daughters. Here's a cell that's making four daughters. Following that over time, you see that those daughters bud out, those quadruplets bud out at about the same time as the twins. There's not really any significant delay. The quadruplets are a little bit, are slightly smaller on average than the twins, but there's a range of sizes even for the twins. As you can see, this was a twin, and it's pretty small compared to these guys, which are a bit larger. Okay, so that was a surprise, because the religion had been that it never makes anything but two, but in fact it can make other numbers. All right. Another example. Now this is with the YFP histone. So here's a vacuole that contains four parasites in interphase. This vacuole contains nine parasites, and two of them are making four daughters. So how do you get nine? Question one. And that odd numbers of parasites had been seen in vacuoles before, and it had always been attributed to asynchronous division, so that one set of parasites would divide and another would not, in spite of the fact that no one ever saw an asynchronous division, including us, we've not seen it. So that was a puzzle. But then it turned out that was just wrong. It does make odd numbers of daughters. So here's a vacuole containing 17 adult parasites. All are producing daughters. 12 are producing twins. 5 are producing triplets. Okay? So first, just think about this. 17 parasites in this vacuole. So in the previous generation, when it was approximately half of that number, at least one of those must have been the product of a multiple daughter event, an odd number. So the fact that all 17 of these are producing daughters means that the progeny of multiple daughter events are probably viable and capable of going through the cell cycle. And we'll come back to that, but that turns out to be true. So in a typical lab culture, you'd see maybe a fifth to a third of the vacuoles will have parasites in them. The vast majority will be twins. Triplets or quadruplets are rare. Of the 1% remaining, most will be triplets or quadruplets, but we've seen up to 8.
So triplets are really weird, right? So are you sure that this isn't out of plane? I mean, just checking. Okay, so it really is 3.
It really is 3. And while I'm going to go through that and hammer it home, it is definitely 3.
Yeah. So you said if there were 17 mother cells, they were all, so one of them must have been the triplet.
Must have been a triplet.
They don't die? The 18th one couldn't have died?
We've never seen that, no. And I'll
never die when they're inside.
I mean, so in this particular case, I can't guarantee you that one didn't die. But what I can show you is that in general, they don't die, and I can prove that to you directly. I'll do that in a minute.
So you say 99% are twins, but here we see a lot of triplets. So does
exactly.
mean that there's some either epigenetic or genetic cue?
Precisely. So this is the typical pattern. You look all over a culture, and you see twins and twins and twins, and then you'll see one vacuole that it has quadruplets in it, and probably more than one set of quadruplets. So they're clustered like that. You're exactly right. Okay, so how do you get triplets? So tricolor mitosis can occur. Here's an example. Let me show you this movie. For the aficionados, so this is a tubulin stain here to mark that will show the spindle, and this is a histone, which basically marks the DNA. The aficionados will recognize that there's going to be a problem here, because instead of being the expected two bright dots on the rim of the nucleus where the centrioles are, there's actually 3. Oh, and is that going to play? Oh, not going to play. All right, at any rate, it's apparently refusing to play. There it goes, okay. So that can happen, and you can see that in tissue cultures. But for normal cells, as opposed to HeLa cells or cancer cells or something like that, for normal cells, this would normally be a lethal event. The DNA, the partitioning of the DNA will not work out. HeLa cells, you know, things that have been in tissue culture for a long time, they can get away with this kind of nonsense, but a normal cell won't survive that. Okay, so the fact that we have triplets that are being produced, and they're being produced at about the same time, within a few minutes, of the time that twins are being produced. So the daughter budding out seems to be more or less synchronous. Seems to imply that Toxo is making three copies of its DNA at once, which is really hard to credit. Right? Yeah, exactly. So we did some more experiments. So here is a...
I'm going to miss this. So, and you know that it's not, obviously, you think that there's something much more complicated going on, but so it can't just be that they divide, you have to start with one cell, it divides into two, one of those divides again, and the other one doesn't, and now you have three?
So that would be an asynchronous division. So you're talking about one mother makes two daughters and one of those daughters divides. No, that does not happen. We've never seen that. Okay. Until you get an uncountable number of parasites in the vacuole, which is 32 or 64, the divisions are really nicely synchronous.
And what's the timing of that?
The timing? It's about about 6 to 8 hours between.
So my scenario, that would take twice as long.
But we can rule it out directly. I'm going to show you directly that is not... Okay. That may happen. We've never seen it. It may happen. But that's not the explanation for most of this. So in this experiment, DNA content was measured in cells that were producing either twins in blue or triplets in red or quadruplets in green. All right. So our calibration here is a cell producing the normal twins. So we would call that 2N DNA. Right. We can measure by quantitative fluorescence, we can measure the amount of DNA in the cell. Right. So we call that 2N. And just so you can interpret the rest of it, the standard error of the mean in that measurement of 2N is 0.02 N. And so that's the standard error of the mean. So that was about 300 measurements. So the standard deviation would be of the order of, let's say, 0.3 N or something like that for a single measurement. Okay, so here's a histogram for twins. Virtually all of them are at 2N. There's some that contain a little bit more DNA. This is right on the border of statistical significance, I would say. But in view of what's coming later, I think that's probably real. If you look at the ones that are producing three daughters, there's a peak at three and then a long tail on the high side. If you look at four, there's a peak at four. This we can explain by saying, well, it hadn't quite finished DNA replication, so this is lower. This is going to be harder to explain. Okay.
Are the triplets that are way over to the left viable?
So far as we know, all of these are viable. We have we've never seen one that is not viable. We've checked that in a number of different ways. First, just by letting them grow, watching them, and also we've gone through and looked at the content of these multiple daughters for everything that we can assay with our probes for, you know, ER and Golgi, and they seem to have a complete complement of everything they need.
But and, I mean, doesn't the data say that they don't have a complete complement of one really important thing,
like
the DNA? Genome?
Yeah, that would be the quick interpretation, but it's wrong. I'll show you. Okay, so if you actually look at the nuclear morphology in these cells, then it becomes probably more confusing. Here's the morphology in cells that are producing three daughters. So you can have, and this measurement, so this would be one end of DNA, one end of DNA, one end of DNA, and those are going to go into those three daughters. You can have this situation, one end of DNA and two end of DNA. So this looks like you replicated your DNA, and then that piece of DNA, that patch of DNA replicated again, but this one did not. All right, so that's okay. This one is 4N, and it's going to produce three daughters. Okay, in four daughters, you can have this, just looks like 4N, you can have 2N plus 2N, and you can have this 3N plus one in. So this looks like you had a replication event. One of those copies replicated again, and then one of those copies replicated again. And then it'll get packed into $4. This gets packed into $3. So what happens is it apparently just discards one end of DNA, decides to make $3 instead of $4. Okay? All right, so I've skipped a lot of the data that shows that these are viable. We'll show some more I'll show you some more in a minute that proves they're viable. But the next question you think of is, or the question we thought of was, are these a weird subpopulation of cells in the culture? And then some mutant that is coexisting at low levels with the wild type. And so that next we tried to sort that out.
And why doesn't this, why isn't the explanation of this the same as the answer you gave me before? If you replicate your DNA and then replicate it again, why does it address that synchrony?
I thought you were talking about a replication event followed by a cytokinesis event.
I think I was, but now if these guys have to do, some of them have to do replication.
More than once, yeah. And remember, this is all in one mother cell. There is no membrane separating those. So one of these patches of DNA has decided it's going to replicate again, and this patch decides against it. So then you've got three copies, and now that'll be packaged into $3. Or maybe they both decide they're going to replicate again. Then you've got four copies, and then you can make either $4 or $3.
Shouldn't that still take longer than a normal cell just making?
So I'm not sure whether it should or not. It doesn't. But I can show you why it doesn't.
Okay.
And I'll summarize why it doesn't in a second. Okay. All right, so here's an experiment where we sorted a population by their DNA content, which we can do in a number of different ways. And if you do that, you get a whole pile of cells that will have what we call one end DNA, and about 5 or 10% of cells that will have twice that much, and a small, very much smaller number that will have three times or more of that. Okay. Sort these into populations, and then look to see what fraction of them produce multiple daughters. So if it was a strictly genetically heritable event, then these guys should produce multiple daughters and these shouldn't, and that would be our weird subpopulation. So here's the pre-sort. In this culture, about 9% were producing multiple daughters. This is much higher than normal, but you, as I'll show you, you can disturb this by relatively mild treatments. Any kind of stress can put this up. So this pre-sort culture had about 9%. The 1N DNA produced about 12% multiple daughters. The 2N DNA produced about 13%. And the 3N, the guys that were guaranteed to have come from triplets or quadruplets, produced the same number. So apparently it doesn't make any difference whether you were a twin or a triplet or a quadruplet or whatever. You can still make twins and triplets and quadruplets, and at the same frequency as all the other cells in the population. So that's a bulk measure. You can do this the harder way, which is you can take a culture and watch with a marker for the nucleus, and you can identify cells that are making triplets or quadruplets or whatever. And then you can just poke them with a micropipette so they come out of the cell, and then pick them up individually and put them in another dish and watch to see what they do individually. Okay? And when you do that, there's what you find. So viability means the fraction of vacuoles that were recovered after this transfer to a new dish. And that loss includes things that are really dead, which is probably a very small fraction, things that were lost in the pipette, or things that were not lost in the pipette but simply failed to invade in the new dish. Okay, so, all right, so before the transfer, they were making about 5% multiple daughters. If you transfer twins, then after transfer, they make about 15 or 20% multiple daughters. If you take triplets or quadruplets and transfer them, they make a little bit higher frequency. So apparently, and this, of course, is much higher than that, so this is what I'm saying, lots of forms of stress will increase the fraction of multiple daughters. Okay.
So
So can you look further at the stress? Can you just poke it with the needle?
We tried a bunch of things. You can change the CO2 in the incubator. You can do various things and put it up. But the basal level is quite low, less than 1%. There have been, since that work, this is quite old now, since that time, people have isolated mutants that have very high frequency, 50 or 60%. Those mutated genes are not what you would think of as cell cycle genes. They are parts of the cytoskeleton that form the scaffolding. I forgot the other one, but they're not things that you would immediately think of that would be regulating this.
So if this is a stress response, are you starting to see bradyzoic expression? Are you starting to see anything that essentially is to do with the transition into the Brady?
They don't behave like bradyzoites. We have not gone and checked the expression of bradyzoite-specific genes, but they certainly don't behave like it. They grow and invade and so forth like tigerzoites. Yeah.
Well, actually, at the time we were doing this, I looked at cultures where it's under stress, physically bradyzoite-induced. It doesn't look like the frequency has been much higher.
Right. Oh, actually, the other thing we did, I've forgotten now, we took a strain that doesn't form bradyzoites, okay, and it does the same thing.
And activity of the host immune system increase the fraction multiple daughters for the mucus?
Don't know. Whether we don't know. So no one has yet observed, been able to observe that in a real living host. And the cat, So I mentioned at the beginning, in one brief phase of its life cycle, toxoplasma can make multiple daughters. And that happens inside the intestine of the cat. Okay. So what happens is, cat gets infected by various roots, whatever. The cells migrate into the intestinal epithelium of the cat, the parasites. And in there, they, as part of gametogenesis, this is going to be their sexual phase, as part of gametogenesis, they can do a multi-daughter event. Okay. And the product of those will become the gametes. But that's that one situation. Now, whether that's stressful or not, I don't know. But anyway, it can be induced under certain conditions for sure. Okay, the only thing, I think we've covered all that. I don't need to read it, you can read it, but this thing. So you said, we were talking about the timing, right? So what happens is DNA replication between different patches is not coordinated. One patch can replicate and another cannot. But daughter scaffold formation and packaging of the daughters awaits until some stage of DNA replication. So packaging is held up until replication is at a certain stage, and then they're all packaged. So they all come out together. That delay is really quite small within the animals, because if you look at the end result, the timing is about the same. Okay, so that's the end of the first story here. So we're left with more questions. Yeah.
Can you just get back to the point of what do you do if you have an incomplete genome, and how do you live?
So if you have an incomplete genome, it depends on who you are, apparently. So cancer cells often make copies of themselves that are incomplete, but they may have compensating. You know, they have a just total mess as the chromosome content. And some of those additions and subtractions balance out, and they can go on with a weird karyotype. But a normal cell, if you remove a chromosome, is probably not going to be viable.
But you said that everything was viable, like the triplets that came with two NDNA were viable.
They all have the same viability as far as we can tell. Go ahead.
Sorry, Rob, is that correct? Some of the 2N populations, actually, there are... the triplets might have empty. It sort of has empty shell, so it is actually 2N.
I'm sorry.
The 2N, the population where the triplet that has 2N.
Right.
Like some of them, there's a mismatch between the number of daughters and the DNA. So you would get in the end you would get one empty daughter. One empty daughter.
Possible.
So that would be
the... But I don't think I've ever seen that.
Yeah, I have.
So anyway, we wound up with more questions than we started with. how many copies you're going to make, how would you set it up so you can make a variable number, and why on earth would you keep this capability? Why would you want to keep the ability to make a variable number of daughters? That just sounds to me like a very expensive thing to do. Anyway.
So when you have go to diploidy or tetraploidy, multiple copies, is there any studies of mitotic recombination going on between the chromosomes? Markers.
Now, these are. It'd be hard to do, right? Because this is a clonal population, so I'm not sure what recombination.
Yeah,
I don't think the mutation rate is high enough that you would.
You could make mutations, presumably.
Well, remember, it's haploid. Okay. Okay. So. I don't know what that would look like.
So the way that you stated that, I mean, it makes it sound like you think that there's a regulatory system in place to make sure that this happens. And what about the alternative that, the control isn't very tight and stuff goes wrong every now and then and it doesn't matter?
There's probably something like that is going on. That there's a limit to the precision with which you can control that. It just surprises me that it can deal with the consequences of that kind of construction accident so gracefully. And I would have thought that to maintain that capability, that kind of flexibility, would be expensive. You'd have to maintain a lot of circuits and capabilities that wouldn't be necessary if you just said, okay, we're going to make $2, and if you don't make $2, you're dead.
So, follow up directly on that. Like, I mean, isn't it possible that a lot of that flexibility and mechanisms and so on are exactly the same ones that deal with mistakes when you are making two daughters? So that's why it doesn't need to be that expensive, because making two daughters is also hard. You know, most things are hard. And that the error correction mechanisms can generalize. You know, when we look at the thing, three looks like two, but from the molecular mechanisms point of view, in many cases, it's just local error correction for what those circuits are seeing.
That sounds reasonable to me. I guess one step is how would you go about figuring out that?
I know, perturb the ones that are. Maybe it has something to do with perturbing it when it is just two. If there are ways of seeing how corrections are made, you know, I would predict, for example, that there are times that it's making two that it might abort and not make two and only make one, given a sufficient, just like, for example, if you took out some of the DNA content or whatever, just like it aborts with three, so that you could see some of the same processes with the making two as with the making multiple.
So I'm trying to put this in the context of the other apicomplexa.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Plasmodium makes, so Moschazogny makes multiples. Is that a faithful number or is that a variable number?
Nobody knows.
Okay. What about in any of the other apicomplexa?
I think you could say with confidence it's not known.
Okay.
It's very different. I'm sure you can do this kind of tagging. I mean, the cell cycle was not worked out until we could do the tagging. Basically,
right.
It was not known. It was known that the replication time was about 8 hours, and that was basically about a day.
Is the whole set of observations here based on one haploid genotype? Or different isolates?
A couple of different strains, but not any large number.
You know, the slide you showed of the different tissues, there were some neutrophils around in the brain. Is that the brain particularly sensitive to
I'm not sure those are neutrophils.
Yeah, they look like it.
So in acute toxoplasmosis, of course, you do get an inflammatory reaction. Mm-hmm. You would not get the brain lesions and so forth.
And in the cats, in the intestine, is there an inflammatory reaction?
No,
what's the tropism there? Why that particular host and cell? Nobody knows.
I don't know. Certainly, if any member of the cat family, not just the most.
It's a
the reproduction, the sexual reproduction between host cell, is it inbred, or is it, I mean, is there,
I'm sorry?
This is getting to a different topic, but the sexual cycle that's in cats, are they inbred, are they mating with their close relatives?
I think we don't know. It would be a numbers game. How often does it get infected, and how often is it likely to get infected with more than one? And I think we don't know.
What is the heterozygosity? So how often does a gene have two different alleles?
Because if it's
selfing all the time, there should be very limited.
There are three, subtypes that are been recognized worldwide, and they seem to be covered.
Okay, so this is quite interesting. The question is, if you look at the two haploid genomes, is it diploid or haploid?
Haploid for all of its life, except there's one rephase.
There's no way of doing that. I'm sorry, stop that.
Just a comment on the natural history. Just intuitively, it makes sense that if you have a primary secondary host and one of your asexual stage host is warm-blooded animals, it kind of makes sense that your sexual stage would be cats, which among the carnivora are quite broad in terms of the kind of taxa that they'll go after. If you were looking at the canids, for example, the canids don't generally predate birds. At least passerines, for example, cats do. So it might make some logical sense.
Okay. All right, so in the second episode of this How to Build a Parasite Set theme, I'm going to talk about this issue in building a parasite. How do molecules get to the right place? Of course, like John said, we're going to give small picture talk, so I'm going to focus on how we fail to understand a particular molecule get to a particular region of the cortical cytoskeleton of the parasite. And the cortical cytoskeleton, again, is this structural framework that underlying the cortex.
Okay, so
John just told you about the parasite replication, is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. And in order for the parasite to cause disease, it actually needs to complete two other steps that together with the replication forms the so-called lytic cycle. So that forms of this lytic cycle consists of invasion, replication, and egress. Okay. So the invasion, we call it this way, the step invasion, because this is the entry step for the parasite to get into the host cell. And this is a process that's actively driven by the parasite itself. Now here, I'm going to show you a movie that shows how these parasites move in and out of the host. So these are four parasites. They're moving out of this host. This is a host cell nucleus. And this parasite right now is pausing. Here it goes. It's moving through the plasma membrane of this host. So as you can see here, whenever the parasite moves through the plasma membrane, there's this really tight constriction that forms around the parasite body. And which means that in this process, the parasite has to withstand a lot of mechanical stress. And it can do so because it has a very robust and flexible cortical cytoskeleton, which is one of the reasons we're interested in this set of structure. Now, at the end of the invasion, the parasite will establish a vacuole within which it will become non-motile and start to replicate. So John, I've told you that these parasites replicate by forming daughters inside the mother, and the cortical cytoskeleton forms a framework for the daughter scaffold. So the cytoskeleton is, again, also essential for the parasite replication. Now, after multiple rounds of replication, the vacuole will get large. Eventually, the energy source in the host cell will be depleted, and the parasite can sense that stage by bursting out of the host cell and reinvading to new adjacent host cells. Right? So as you can see here, this reiteration of the lytic cycle is the basis for the pathogenesis of this disease. Right? So the repetitive cycle of that eventually will cause massive tissue damage, as you see here in this MRI scan of this AIDS patient. I also want to point out that all these parasites, they have exactly the same size and shape. And this very characteristic banana-like shape is very likely to have been selected for during evolution for optimal, because even the subtle change in this shape can dramatically affect the ability of the parasite to move in a three-dimensional matrix. Now, the shape of the parasite is also defined and maintained by the cortical cytoskeleton. Right? So this cortical cytoskeleton is essential for providing mechanical stability for the cortex, for making the shape, and also for replication. Now, the cytoskeleton is formed of several sets of biopolymers. This includes 22 core tubules that spiral down two-thirds of the parasite body from this ring-like structure at the parasite apical end. Now, just for the non-cell biologists, a microtubule is a polymer that's formed of repetitive units or subunits. And each subunit is formed of two globular proteins, alpha tubulin and beta tubulin. And in each tube, these alpha-beta heterodimers are aligned in columns, so 13 columns in one tube that organize into this tubular structure. Right, so, and all these subunits in a polymer are pointing towards the one direction, which means that this polymer is polarized. One end of the structure is different from the other end. Now, if we look down at a tube, such as shown here, this is an EM cross-section of a single microtubule, you will see a circle with 13 blobs. Okay. So each fiber right here shown in this cartoon is one microtubule. So here I'm going to show you an image that these are four live parasites expressing fluorescently tagged tubulin so that we can see the tubulin continuous structures in these parasites. And you can appreciate that these parasites are dividing because there are daughter cells making in each being made in each parasite. And in this rotational view, you can appreciate that these cortical microtubules are again distributed at the cortex, which means that if we look through the parasite in a projection view like this, we'll be seeing this kind of crisscross pattern because we'll be seeing the microtubules on both surfaces of the parasite. Okay. And there, besides the cortical microtubules, there are also other tubulin containing structures showing this image, but I'm not going to talk about it for the most part. I'm going to touch upon them at the end of the talk. Now, these cortical microtubules are not bare, right? So the core structure, again, is this tube that forms up alpha, beta tubulins, but on the surface of these tubes, they're heavily coated with associated proteins, and we knew this from earlier electron microscopy study. Now, recently, my lab identified a number of these proteins that coat these cortical microtubules. So here shows one example, let's just call it protein A. That, as you would expect, coats the cortical microtubules from the apical to the distal end. Again, we're looking at the projection view so that we're seeing both surfaces of the parasite and the cortical microtubules on both surfaces of the parasite. I think a bit more surprisingly is that we actually also found a different set of coating protein that differentially decorate the microtubules. So here it shows two examples. Let's call it protein B that is only localized to the apical section of the cortical microtubules, and this other protein C that's localized to distinct regions of the cortical microtubules. Okay. So here it shows on the right shows the localization of protein B in these two parasites. So this is an overlay with the localization of protein B and cortical microtubules. Again, you can see that it is indeed restricted to the apical section. Okay, so this is...
Yes. Do you know why they swirl around like that? Is there a reason for shape or stability or structure?
We would like to think that there is a reason, but we don't know what the reason is. Yeah. So it's extremely reproducible. Every parasite has exactly the same organization. This is basically a left-handed spiral. We think that these microtubules play some role in guiding the long-distance movement of the parasite movement, but we don't have any data for that.
So you get shape mutants, which are no longer banana-shaped? are the microtubule cells swirled in that way?
So those mutant alters the parasite shape, not by changing the microtubule, but by something else. Actually, I don't know if people have looked at the microtubule organization in those guys yet.
Also, are you thinking that there might be cross-linkers that help it to be organized in such a regular manner?
Yeah, I think we know that there are cross-linkers, from earlier EM studies. And if you, these fibers are basically plastered against the membrane. And then if you look at the membrane, there are many rows of transmembrane particles that perfectly align with these microtubules. So, and then if you look at the periodicity of these particles, they actually coincide with what you found in the microtubule as well. So there's definitely cross-linkers. We don't know what they are yet, but they're definitely cross-linkers.
So I don't know whether this is relevant or not. I'm just remembering my freshman physiology course about 100 years ago when, so if you take a balloon and you take burlap and you wrap it around the balloon exactly linearly, not twisted like that, you can't twist or bend the balloon, but if you wrap it at an angle, then you have all this torsional flexibility. So it could be simply that by having these tubulins on an angle, you have a kind of torsional flexibility that you might need, for example, to move through space or through the membrane.
Yeah, I mean it could be when through three-dimensional matrix, these guys move in a left-handed helical sort of trajectory as well. So I mean, we really like to believe that these guys have something to do with that, but we don't have any evidence.
If you look at the protein structure, can you explain sort of from the mutation how the structure would have it go in that sort of a...
So the protein structure, which protein?
Well, I presume tubulin.
So the tubulin, no, I see, this guy, no. So these tubulins are just, plain vanilla tubulin. They are essentially identical as what you would find in mammalian cells. So. And then if you express human tubulin in these guys, you would just get incorporated, making the same structure just fine.
Say that again, you're expressing human tubulin?
Yeah, you can express,
what happens?
Basically you get the same thing. So by changing tubulin, at least the way we're doing it, we don't have a dominant effect on the organization of the microtubule.
Any mutants in protein B?
Yes, but can I touch upon this later? So this, I'm not going to actually talk about protein function because there's another really complicated story here. What we're concerning is it's a very simple question. How does this protein get to that particular place? Because for us, it's puzzling. Because if you look at the microtubule, since it's formed of repetitive units, one section of the microtubule is identical with the next one. So, but then somehow this protein has the ability to differentiate one section from the next. So that's a kind of interesting puzzle. Now, so this protein B looks like, the localization is simple enough. We thought, okay, we'll give this one a go. So this question actually has two parts. Now, first, we need to know when this protein is targeted, meaning is it targeted during or after the polymerization of these microtubules? And the second question is, what restricts the localization of this protein in this particular region? Now, this first question is actually reasonably easy to answer in our system because, as John told you, these guys making daughters de novo inside the mother. So, which means that as the daughters are being made, the cortical microtubules of the daughters are formed as part of daughter scaffold. Okay, so, the old cortical microtubules will associate with the mother, and the new cortical microtubules will associate with the daughters. And we can easily distinguish the two. Which means that we can simply just look at parasite at different stages of daughter formation and look to see where this protein is. And indeed, we found that it is targeted when the microtubules are being made. So here it shows two parasites, where these are the mature parasites, and at the apical end, you can see that this capping region is covered by this protein, protein B. And in each parasite, there are two flower-like structure, and these are the nascent daughters, which clearly contain this protein. Now here shows parasites at later stages of a daughter formation, where we can see the dome-shaped-like structure of the daughters very easily. And again, you can see that this protein is targeted to the apical end. Now, okay, so that's the first question, which is pretty easy. The second question is a bit harder. What restricts this protein within this particular region? Why doesn't this protein bind to the entire length of the polymer or go somewhere else? Now, to answer that, our first idea is simple. Let's just say that for some reason, binding site is only available in this cap region. That means that if that's the case, if we alter the amount of this protein or the pattern of protein expression in the cell, this shouldn't change the localization of the protein because, again, if the binding site is only present.
What kind of an idea would you have? I mean, what does that, I get what you're saying, but what does it mean, binding sites? Like, are you thinking of the GTP cap, or are you thinking about some thing that's nucleated off the top? In other words, the tubulin is the tubulin.
Right.
It's hard to know what you mean by that.
Yeah, no, we didn't know. So at this point, this is just a vague idea I'll get to this point. Okay. One of the idea that we had that didn't really.
What's the polarity of your microtubules?
Well, we can think this is the minus n, this is a plus n. This is because it's that's how it grows, but we don't have direct evidence actually.
Do you happen to know if protein B recovers if you have sort of a photo bleaching experiment?
I'll get to that. Yeah, so that will be in the second part. Okay, so let's just say that, like what Rob said, this is a very vague thing, binding sites only available in the cap protein. But let's just suppose that, there is a black box here, there's binding sites. But then that means that if you alter the level of this protein B in the cell, that shouldn't change the localization pattern. But that's not the case. So here we generate a situation in which we express protein B from a different gene regulatory element from the one that they normally use, and you can see that it clearly codes the length of the entire length of the polymer. Okay, so here are two examples. On the left are two parasites that are making small daughters. So these are the young daughters in this flower-like shape, and on the right shows two parasites that are making fairly large daughters right before the budding. And in both cases, this protein can bind the entire length of the polymer, but it just doesn't do so under a normal situation when it's regulated by its own regulatory elements. Okay, so that idea is out the door. The second idea is then, maybe it's simply the issue of the time window within which the protein is available. Now, let's just suppose that this protein is only available in the cytoplasm when this section of the microtubule is being made. Now, in order for this to generate this kind of pattern, besides the requirement for the time window, you also need to have the second condition, which is that this protein have to associate with microtubule irreversibly once bound, because otherwise the molecules will dissociate with this section and bound to the distal sections, and this will end up, you'll end up with a uniform coating along the entire length of the polymer. Okay, so we decided that, okay, we'll test the second condition first. This is where the FRAP experiment comes in. Okay, so we use this technique called fluorescence recovery after photobleaching, in which we first label the protein of interest with fluorescent markers. So these are this represents our proteins, and these are will be the fluorescent tags. And then we introduce a strong laser beam to bleach a specific area in the cell, the area of interest. and then simply watch what happened to see whether or not there is recovery in this bleached region. Okay, and then by measuring the fluorescence intensity in this area of interest, we can construct a curve like this and compare the fluorescence intensity change before and after photobleaching. Okay. Now here in this particular example, you see that after photobleaching, there is steady increase of fluorescence in this bleached area. And this, there could be two causes for this. The first scenario is shown here, which is that there is protein exchange between the bleached area and the rest of the cell, which means that the dark molecules will move out, and some of the fluorescent molecules will move in, and this will give you increase of fluorescence in this region. However, there could also be a second scenario, which is not shown here, which is that the structure you're interested in might be growing. Right, so in that case, new fluorescent molecules will get incorporated into the structure. You will see a recovery, but there might not be protein exchange. And I'm going to show you, in our experiment, I'm going to show you how we can distinguish these two things. Now, in the third scenario, suppose that your structure is stable, is no longer growing, and your protein is associated with that structure stably, then in this phase, after the photobleaching, you should see a flat line. There should be no recovery. Okay. So these are the three different possibilities. Okay, so now here I'm going to show you some real FRAP experiments. We're targeting this vacuole that contains these two parasites, where their apical ends are pointing leftwards. And in this fluorescence image, you can clearly see that this is the apical cap region of these two parasites. Okay, so there are two parasites here. And in there, you might be able to see some fainter structures. These are the nascent daughters. So at this time point, at this resolution, we cannot resolve the two daughters. But later on, you will see that there are actually two daughters containing this blob. Now, in this experiment, we bleached this mother, the cap region in this mother, and one of the daughters in the same cell. Okay, and then let's see what happens. Okay, so the mother fluorescence is gone, and here is the daughter that we targeted, indicated by the magenta arrow. Okay, so if you follow the magenta arrow, you'll notice that after photobleaching, there's clearly fluorescence material that's incorporated into the bleached region, whereas that's not the case for the mother. So the mother, once it's bleached, it is very, very hard to follow. Now, also, I want you to follow this particular mother parasite, the apical region, indicated by the green arrow here, where you can see that it gets dragged to the base of the daughter parasites and eventually gets degraded. Okay, so One thing that I want to remind you that when you bleach a structure, the structure is still there. It just, the fluorescence is no longer there. Right? So it appears to be dark in this fluorescence image, but the underlying structure is still there. Okay, so there are a lot of things going on. Let's just look at some measurements. So here it shows in green the fluorescent intensity measurement of this unbleached or untargeted mother, in where at the beginning you see the slight drop in fluorescence intensity, probably because the laser beam gets kind of spilled over to the adjacent mother. But after that, it's pretty steady until in the end there's this rapid drop of fluorescence intensity because of the degradation of the mother cap region. Whereas in the bleached mother, shown in cyan here, you first have a very steep drop. And then it pretty much fluctuates around the basal level. And this is, the fluctuation is very most likely to be artifactual because, as you can appreciate here, once the mother is bleached, it's kind of difficult to follow the position of the mother accurately. Okay. So that's the mothers. So what happens to the daughters? Now, in both bleached daughter, which is showing magenta here, and unbleached daughter, which is showing red here, you see a steady increase of fluorescence over time. But you can see that there's a constant difference between the intensity of the unbleached and bleached daughter, and that is maintained throughout the experiment, which means that the population of the molecules that we bleached at the beginning of the experiment never gets replaced. So they remain bound to this structure.
The bleached daughter, the purple was inside of the cyan and the red inside of the green?
Purple is inside cyan and the red inside.
I'm just trying to, you have a bleached daughter and not
a bleached
daughter. Oh, I
see. No, so the red is, so there are, we're talking about four daughters here. One is bleached, three are unbleached. So this is the average of the three that's
so
unbleached.
The one that was bleached inside of the mother?
Yes.
And was there another one inside of the mother that was not bleached?
Yes.
So the mother is bleached?
The mother apical end is bleached.
Uh-huh. But okay, so you can control it finely enough to just hit the apical end, but not the daughter.
Right. That's right.
And this is the average of the three, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the average of the three untargeted daughters. And you see the fluctuation here. This is focus drift. Any more questions? Yeah, so basically it tells us that this coding protein, this protein B, does associate with microtubule irreversibly once bound. Right? So this is coming from the data from the daughter cell photobleaching. Okay, so I want to point out that we're looking at very, very slow events here. So this, we're definitely not diffusion limited. So these cells, again, have small 2 micron in width and 7 micron long. And it will take a molecule less than a second to cross the entire cell. But here, the recovery event here, we're sampling every 5 minutes. Okay, so this is very, very slow. Okay, so the second condition, this condition is satisfied, but what about the first one? Is this protein only available when this apical section of a microtubule is formed? Now, to address that, we can simply track the fluorescence intensity of the apical region in the daughters with respect to the length of the cortical microtubules. Okay. So here it first shows the fluorescence intensity measurement in mother, showing in blue here, which is reasonably steady, whereas in daughters and in this initial phase, you can see a very rapid increase until it reaches a plateau. So what about the cortical microtubules? So here it shows some cartoons that indicates the relative length of the cortical microtubules with respect to this apical cap region highlighted by protein B. And this is a point where we can say with confidence that the cortical microtubules are longer than the apical cap region. But as you can see here, this is right in the middle of the growth phase. Right? So which means that after the microtubules have grown longer than this region, there are still continuously new molecules added to this region. Okay. So first condition is not satisfied, and then the second idea is out again. Okay, so now we're getting pretty desperate, and this is getting back to Rob's question about this mysterious binding size. Let's just say that we invent this mysterious protein masking protein X that somehow prevents this protein B from binding to a distal region, right? So this is a fancier way of saying that there is a specific binding site for protein B in this region. Now, but if you think about it, there are actually quite a few conditions that this protein have to meet. First, this protein needs to bind to microtubule much faster or much better than protein B. And since we already know that protein B binds to the microtubule irreversibly, it's unlikely that it can bind to the microtubule even more tightly. So it has to get to the microtubule faster. Now, and second, the condition is that it can only be available after the apical section of the microtubule is made, because otherwise it will block the access of this protein in this region. Okay. Now, again, this is just a fancier way of saying that binding site is only available in this region, so which means that we still have this result to reckon with. Right, so this protein, apparently, if you express it enough, it can bind to the entire length of cortical microtubules. So this basically says that in this situation that we create if this master protein, masking protein X exists, the amount of this protein has to be tiny compared with the level of protein B in this situation. Okay, so we don't know that. Since we don't know what the masking protein is, the X is, or even if it exists. So this obviously is not, at the moment, it's not a testable model. Okay, so even for this really, really simple situation.
What's the purpose of C again?
Sorry?
What's the purpose of having just a small amount?
So if you don't have a small amount of, if, say that in this situation, your B is the same, is comparable in level as X, then you should see a gradient, right? So because if you satisfy the first two conditions, the masking proteins start to get expressed at this point when the microtubule is this long. So this part should be coded more strongly than the rest of the microtubule if this protein exists, if it has the same similar amount as with your protein. So basically, the only explanation, if this protein exists, the only explanation is that here we're overwhelming the system by expressing just a load of protein. But we did some measurement, we don't think so.
Where does EB1, sorry, slightly technical, but maybe you'll go, where does this end-binding protein EB1 bind, just to go to the question of the polarity here?
So the end binding, we express the human EB1 in toxo. It doesn't decorate ends as prettily as you see in mammalian cell. And I think it's a long time ago. I think it actually codes pretty much.
Maybe because it's overexpressed.
Yeah, maybe it's overexpressed. Yeah.
But do they have plus tips in general?
Well, they don't.
I think there's EB1.
Well, there is EB1 protein, but I think it's probably doing something quite different. Not in the sense of the dynamic plus tip that you would see in mammalian cells, in that these guys, once they are made, they're pretty much there. So there's no growth and shrinkage. So it's extremely, these proteins are extremely stable. Oh, sorry, these polymers are extremely stable. So we've never seen, say, catastrophe in these persons.
I mean, there are also many motors.
There are a lot of motors.
So you have motors that could go to the minus or plus ends of.
We actually recently find a kinesin that's concentrated in this ring-like structure, but we haven't found anything that's concentrated on the other end.
How fine a scale of gene expression data do you have over the cell cycle?
How fine? Not very. It's a bit hazy. I think every hour-ish. So it's not very high resolution.
Because I'm wondering if potentially you could test B by looking for genes that are upregulated right at that point.
Yeah, I mean so. This, we identified maybe 6 or 7 coding proteins. They all have very similar profiles. And so somebody was asking about the question about gene function. So we actually knocked out a bunch of them, including this one. And the localization of those proteins seem to be not interdependent. That's another puzzling part. So that's why I would think this idea is really probably not right, because so far we have not found it.
Have you considered post-translational modifications?
Yeah, we have, but I guess you essentially will run into the same problem, in the sense that how do you initially generate this differential pattern, right? So how would, even for the post-translational modifying enzyme, they also have to somehow be able to differentiate, say, this part versus that part.
Well, they're located, for instance, in that area.
Could be, yeah. So, we can add enough parameters to make this thing work, but it's just, at the moment, we for the stuff that we know, we don't have a testable model.
So, post-translational modification, I'm just taking care of some of that, and that's protein B is the masking protein, in a sense. So you don't, you no longer need something that finds faster and better, and you no longer need the amount to be minuscule. You only need a bit.
Right.
You know, so it really reduces. It's not like it's the same problem. It reduces a three-part problem to a one-part problem.
But you still have this problem. If you express it under, it goes everywhere if you give it a chance.
But that's, because all these proteins have some affinity for tubules. And so if you increase the concentration, most of them start.
Yeah, possibly. So, yeah.
I mean, if protein B is a sort of self-seeding and you break the chain, you know, then that stops it, you know, by post-translationally modifying it so that it no longer self-seeds. You know, but if you express it, it will reseed in multiple places throughout, because sort of nucleation seeding reactions tend to be highly concentration dependent, you know, exquisitely concentration dependent. So I don't think that's a problem.
Awesome.
I think you know.
To follow up on her nucleation and seeding, so just a, I would say a general cooperativity thing. If that really is the minus ends of the microtubules, maybe this is even something related to putrumenin, or but you know something. If you could target minus ends and then bind cooperatively, I think you might get a structure like that, right? Because it actually looked like it kind of fell off in concentration as well, doesn't it? Does it get on the pictures?
Yeah, we actually talked about it yesterday. It looks pretty sharp, actually. Let me just go back.
Basically, we're seeing our point spread function on the edge.
So. Yeah. So I mean, I mean, we need some quantitation here. We also, I think. We also need some sort of simulation to basically give us some constraints in terms of what's possible, what's not. But, yeah.
Are they only on the microtubule?
Are they only on the microtubule? That's a good question. We know they're on the microtubule. We don't know if they're only on the microtubule.
So they could be binding to the cortex as well.
Could be, right? Then you push the question backwards, and so then you know what makes the cortex different. So yeah, that's the issue. We thought that we will be able to get to the heart of the problem, this particular one, pretty easily, but it's much more difficult than we had expected. Okay, so I'm gonna get down to the. Sorry. Okay, so now, this is just to show you another example of differential localization. This protein C that I referred to earlier, that localized to the two distinct sections of the microtubules, this apical ring-like structures, and the long, fairly long segment of coding. But between the two sections, there's a gap. Right? So if we can understand how protein B to get to this particular region, then obviously we don't have no idea how this protein have this particular pattern. But to make things even more hopeless, besides cortical microtubules, we have several other tubulin containing structures, including these two short microtubules, each of which is about 1 micron long, inserted into this channel that's formed by this organelle called apical complex, as well as 14 novel tubulin polymers, which are formed of tubulins, but they're not microtubules. So here shows the EM cross-section of a single conoid fiber, where you can see that it's organized into this ribbon shape instead of a canonical tube-like structure. And these fibers, they are made of the same tubulin as all these canonical microtubules. If you express human tubulin in the parasite, it also gets incorporated into the fiber. So the tubulin, again, is not the reason for this different structure. It has to be some specific binding proteins that make this that make this fiber into this weird shape. And of course, everybody knows that there's this other set of microtubule binding to containing structures, and in our case, it's in the nucleus that's responsible for segregating chromosomes. Okay, so this is a hard problem. Help.
So we're
work in other organisms have shown you can see sort of similar patterns where certain proteins are decorating different parts of the microtubules. So either like microtubules at the plus and the microtubules are ones at the very tip, there are ones which are a little bit further down, and then there are ones which decorate the lattice but not in that plus region. And so I think there are at least some precedents for.
I think I mean there are definitely examples of differential decoration, but I don't think I've seen a satisfying answer yet. Right? Do you? Or I mean, you probably know the literature much better than I do.
Satisfying answer in terms of.
In terms of how is the specific targeting achieved?
So there are examples of like EB1. Recognizes the GTP sort of nucleotide state of the tubulin inside the microtubule.
Right. And so but that is a fairly specific region.
That's a segment. And then I think there's a recent paper on double cortin which says it cannot bind where EB1 is binding because they're binding to the exact same site on the lattice.
Okay.
Right? So then it's decorating parts of it which EB1 is not.
Right. Okay. I definitely agree. There, which is actually the reason that we wanted to look at this for a simple protein first, because I think this could be something generally applicable. But I got a question about the function of these proteins. So it was a pain because when we individually knock out these coding proteins, essentially nothing happens in the conditions that we look at, and so which makes it even more puzzling. Why did the cell go to this great length to make these fancy patterns? And then in the end, it turns out if we knock out multiple proteins that decrease the microtubule in different patterns, and then we see a pretty drastic phenotyping microtubule stability. So that's kind of another. Yes.
In your photo bleaching experiment, have you tried overexpressing and then seeing what kind of dynamics you get there? Because there may be a
weak binding size. Yeah, we did that. No. So in the overexpression experiment, in those cells, if you bleach, you see the same thing. There's no recovery. So it's still a tight binding. You could say that there are two types of time binding size, but then it's just adding more and more parameters.
So I'm curious, have you checked to see in what other organisms, so the other apicomplexa or whatever, these proteins are found, and then also even further back, whether they're homologous to anything that we know something about, and so we can start borrowing?
By just sequence homology, we haven't found any proteins with known function that share homology with these guys. But some of these coding proteins are shared between fairly distantly related apicomplexan parasites. So Toxoplasmodium, which probably separated a couple of million years ago, a couple of hundred million years ago. And also, actually, some of these proteins are found in the photosynthetic relative of apicomplexan parasites. So these are very old set of proteins.
What about in something like ciliates?
Not something that we can say with confidence. It could be that there are some structural conservation, but we can't pick it up.
Okay, thanks.